Would you read right now from the scriptures from the Old Testament book of Numbers, chapter 13, verses 1 through 6. Numbers 13, verses 1 through 6. And before we read, let's ask God's blessing upon the reading and hearing of his word. Our Father in heaven, your spirit inspired men to write the words of your book. And without your spirit, we cannot actually understand or grasp them. We can get the meanings of the words, but we don't understand that they are your word to us and to all people. And so we ask that your spirit, which inspired these words, will likewise open our minds to receive them as your word, to believe them, and to obey them. And this we ask in Christ's name. Amen. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, everyone a leader among them." So Moses sent them from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the children of Israel. Now these were their names: from the tribe of Reuben, Shammua the son of Zachar; from the tribe of Simeon, Shaphat the son of Hori; from the tribe of Judah, Caleb the son of Jephunneh. Adam and Lisa, you have given Caleb quite a name. Caleb Alexander Rennick Edgar. It won't fit on forms, but it's still a great name. One could meditate in different ways on each name. I looked up this morning King Edgar and discovered there is a King Edgar. King Edgar the Peaceful was a Saxon king in the 10th century. And then there's a King Edgar of Scotland, about whom I know absolutely nothing. And in the Bible, genealogies are extremely important. You'll notice that this is Caleb, son of Jephunneh. So Caleb is the son of Adam, the son of William, the son of Robert, the son of Josiah, the son of William Alexander Edgar, the son of William Morrison Edgar, the son of William Edgar, the son of Adam Edgar. Let's go to Rennick, James Rennick, born in Scotland. His father was a weaver. He went to the University of Edinburgh. He joined the Cameronian remnant that was refusing to bow to military pressure or give in to various compromises with the government. He was educated in the Netherlands, where he was ordained. He came back. He preached illegally in the fields. And finally was caught and arrested and was executed by hanging in Edinburgh in February 1688. He was the last of those to be killed in those killing times. Scots ever since have named their children after him. There are so many Rennicks and so many James Rennicks down through the years in Scotland that's a name that, in a way, belongs to Scotland. My wife's great-grandfather, James Edgar, married Mary Jane Stewart. Mary Jane Rennick. And so Mary Jane Rennick married James Edgar down in Wilmington, and they weren't in the Reformed Presbyterian Church, but the name Rennick was there still in the Scottish descendants. And then there's the name Alexander. You only think of Alexander the Great, as he's called. At one point, I found a book in our library out at East High School that had a nicely done account briefly of his life and at length of his battles, with diagrams and accounts. And what his genius was as a commander is that, unlike most ancient armies, when the enemy army came in sight, he would instantly size up the terrain and the enemy and the circumstances and deploy his forces immediately, and they were well-trained and obedient, and he would attack just like this before the other side would get itself set and ready. And so he had victory after victory, but he was also a city builder. Alexandria in Egypt is the most famous, but he actually founded a number of other cities, all named helpfully so you can find them on the map: Alexandria, Alexandretta, and so on. And with him went Greek culture wherever he went. And then there's Caleb. And Caleb first turns up in the Bible in Numbers chapter 13. I read this. He is appointed as one of the 12 spies by Moses. So this morning we're going to do a sermon type that was once popular, but is now forbidden by seminary professors of teaching. This is a character study. And the basis for a character study in the Bible is, first of all, the human fact that we learn by imitation. All parents at some point look at their child, the child says or does something, the parents say, "Where did you get that?" And the wife looks at the husband and says, "Well, duh." And we actually are encouraged in the Bible to imitate other believers. Paul writes to the Corinthians, "Imitate me." That's 1 Corinthians 4:16. He says, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." That's 1 Corinthians 11:1. James says, "Be like Elijah, who knew how to pray." And of course, all of Hebrews 11 is basically, be like Abraham, be like Sarah, be like Moses, and all the way through. So as I say, this used to be a popular sermon type, and you'd pick a character from the Bible. And because the Bible points out flaws in us sinners as well as good things, you'd have in a character study typically things to imitate and things not to imitate. I think it is an important kind of preaching, although I have done very little of it myself. So the message this morning is really quite simple. Imitate Caleb. That's for Caleb. The parents at some point can look at him as he gets older and say, "Caleb, be Caleb." And all the rest of us, imitate Caleb. And there are three things especially to imitate about Caleb. First, his faith and hope. Second, his extraordinary courage. And third, something that speaks to me and my age, how as an old man he was still taking care of his family. So we're going to see these three things in the Bible. When we first read about Caleb, Israel had been gone from Egypt for 2 years. And you, as well as I, can think of all the things that Caleb had heard and seen along with all Israel. The 10 plagues that finally forced Pharaoh to say, "All right, get out of here." The pillar of fire that protected them from Pharaoh's following army when he said, "Wait, we're losing our slaves, we can't do this." The Red Sea parted to allow Israel through, but not Pharaoh's army. Manna in the wilderness, which they were still eating 2 years later. Coming to Mount Sinai, and God speaking to them, giving them the law. The building of the golden calf, and other instances of rebellion among the children of Israel in these first 2 years. And God's patience and God's judgment at the same time. He had seen that the ark was built in which the two tables of stone were put, each with all 10 commandments, I actually think, in there. And the building of the tent where God met with Israel and spoke with Moses. He'd seen all of this, and so had all Israel. So by the time Moses sent 12 men, one for each tribe except for Levi, into Canaan. They had had many, many experiences of God's power, of God's faithfulness, and of God's goodness to them. The question is, would they continue and actually believe these things when faced with a new challenge? So Moses said to them, go through the land and here's their charge. Go up this way into the south and go up to the mountains and see what the land is like, whether the people who dwell in it are strong or weak, few or many, whether the land they dwell in is good or bad, whether the cities they inhabit are like camps or strongholds, whether the land is rich or poor, and whether there are forests there or not. Be of good courage and bring some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the season of the first ripe grapes. And so these 12 men went up into the hills, 3,000, 4,000 feet high by and large. They went down and up and down and up. That's the way the hills are. And they looked at the land, and they observed the people, and they looked at the land's fruitfulness, and they observed the cities. And when they came back, they had their report. Here was their report. There are hills, lots of them. Now, Israel had seen hills before. Mount Sinai is one of a whole range of mountains. There are forests. There is not much in the way of forests on Mount Sinai. The forest meant that there is rain. You understand, don't you, that the children of Israel had grown up in a land where it did not rain. Egypt is the Nile and desert on both sides. I looked up Cairo. Cairo's annual rainfall, 1 inch. As you get towards the Mediterranean Sea, you get a lot more rain, 3 inches. So, to run into a land where it actually rained about 6 months of the year, and there were forests everywhere, that was different, and it was amazing, and it looked wonderful to the spies. And then it was the time of first grapes. That would mean it was Pentecost in the Jewish way of counting things. It was June in our way of counting things. And at one point, one place, they found a bunch of grapes on a bough that was so abundant that they cut off the bough, and then they put it on a pole, and two men carried it shoulder to shoulder. And they came back with pomegranates, and they came back with figs. So they reported to Israel, the land is good, the fruit is abundant, there are forests, which means there is rain. And in the proverbial expression that they used for a wonderful land, it's a land of milk and honey. Actually, you could live a long time on a diet of just milk and honey. Nevertheless, they said, nevertheless, the people are many, not few. The cities are strongholds, cities with walls, not just little places on a hillside. And we saw giants, the sons of Anak there. We can't do it. And the one who spoke up against actually the 10 of them was Caleb. Let me read you his words of faith and hope. Then Caleb quieted the people. Remember, he did this without a bullhorn and without a microphone. So Caleb must have been a commanding figure. After all, he was chosen from all the tribe of Judah to represent Judah. And now I'm going to take a little bit of a side note here about Caleb. Caleb was the son of Jephunneh, and every other place in the Bible, except Numbers 13, which I read, he is called Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite. I never noticed this before. What does it mean that Jephunneh is a Kenizzite? Well, if you go back to Genesis chapter 15, when God is speaking to Abraham and says, tells him, I'm going to give you this land, he names 10 of the peoples living in Canaan. One of them is the Kenizzites. In other words, Jephunneh is not a descendant of Jacob or Isaac or Abraham. And somehow, at least 40 years or 50 years earlier in Egypt, Jephunneh the Kenizzite had joined the tribe of Judah, married one of the daughters of the tribe of Judah, and they'd had a son named Caleb. I find this absolutely fascinating. First of all, how did Jephunneh the Kenizzite end up in Egypt? Well, of course, we don't know. But there was a lot of trade going back and forth, so he could have just been down there trading. And he said, you know what, I'd like a wife. And he got on the internet and he did a little of a connection. No, probably not. All right. Or maybe the Kenizzites had gone down there at the same time as Israel had gone when the great drought was killing everybody all through the Near East. Or some other possibility that I haven't even thought of. But what this shows is that Israel was never a closed clan. God's people are from every nation, every language, every tribe, every kindred, every clan, and it has always been so. And it was always intended to be so. Now, it only became large scale, shall we say, at Pentecost and with Christ coming, but it was always there. And Matthew makes a point of this in his genealogy in chapter 1, where he carefully includes Rahab the Canaanite from Jericho and Ruth the Moabite from Moab, and Bathsheba carefully noted the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So Caleb, son of somebody we might think of as a foreigner, is already so prominent in the tribe of Judah that at the age of 40, the age is given elsewhere, he becomes the representative of the whole tribe going up and back. And when finally they made the report, it was Caleb who spoke up and said, "We can well do it." Let me read you what he said. "Let us go up at once." Sounds like Alexander, doesn't it? We just strike. "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." And then the 12 spies had an argument in front of the whole nation. But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And then they gave a bad report. And they said, "This is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so were we in their sight." And Israel did not share Caleb's faith. Faith in God's goodness, faith in God's power, faith in God's promises, faith that God was with them and would go with them into the land of Canaan that he had long promised. And what's Caleb to do when faced with a nation that is not listening to him? That's a problem that happens actually sometimes to preachers. You preach something to a congregation and they don't want to hear it. Should he just go along with the majority? It would have been easier, at least in the short run. So now we come to the second thing about Caleb. He was a man of courage. What Israel did after they heard the report of the 12 spies was, we read, they cried all night in their tents. Woe is us. It would have been better if we had stayed in the land of Egypt. They'd done this before, and they were doing it again. Our old life was better. Actually, this is not uncommon among new Christians sometimes. Sometimes people become Christians, and they have an unrealistic expectation, sometimes made up in their own minds, sometimes taught to them, that if they just become Christians, all their problems will now be over and it will be smooth sailing from here on out. Now, Jesus never said any such thing. In fact, what he said was, if you want to follow me, get ready for trouble. And so it has often been. But Israel's there crying because things are suddenly looking dangerous and difficult again. And then they begin to grumble against Moses. Moses caused all this trouble. You'd almost think they were saying, we were happy being slaves, and then Moses came and said, the God of your fathers has appeared to me, and we're going to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And it was a rocky path until they left. So they grumbled against Moses. So on the next day in the morning, Caleb from the tribe of Judah and Joshua from the tribe of Ephraim, by the way, the two leading tribes all through Israel's history from now on, they tried to get Israel's attention and reason with them. Now, their way of getting everybody's attention is not our way. They tore their clothes. If I thought you weren't listening and needed to be encouraged to listen, and I stood up here and tore my clothes, well, you can each decide what you would think. But remember, in those days, clothes were very expensive, and you didn't have a whole closet full to go fall back on if you decided to tear your clothes and show how distraught and upset you were. If I were to go out and get into my Honda Odyssey to show all of you how distraught I was, and I drove it right down the hill and into Darby Creek, well, at least I might have your attention. So they tore their clothes, both Joshua and Caleb, and they tried to reason with them. Chapter 14, verses 6 through 10. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, the land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. And it is easy for us sitting in our pews to say, that was a good sermon, and they should all have listened to them. But of course, we're not faced with walled cities, nor giants, nor what Israel was faced with. It required faith to listen to what Caleb and Joshua had to say. And Israel lacked faith. It also lacked courage. And so they turned into a mob. You know about a mob. You cannot reason with a mob. You cannot say to a mob, listen, this isn't fair process. There's a process for doing these things. And a mob will suddenly attack with fury as though it were a band of hornets with one mind. And when and how, you cannot predict. I faced a mob that wanted my life once, and I actually don't like to remember it. It was the summer of 1974, and we lived in the island of Cyprus. The Turkish armies had come in and grabbed the top half of the island, and the Greeks were looking for somebody to blame, and they were blaming the United States, a convenient country that everybody finds to blame for things. The American ambassador was shot and killed in the capital city of Nicosia, and my friend Don Piper and I were driving through the mountains up to the campground of the American Academy. And we got stopped at a roadblock. And we talked to these guys in Greek, which surely meant that we were American spies. So they arrested us. And they took us to the nearest village, into the police office, brought in the head policeman, and said to him, "We caught these American CIA spies driving through the mountains here." Now, Don and I, by this time, had decided that speaking English was our better bet, and we pretended to know and understand no Greek. So we listened to them argue back and forth. The men who arrested us said they are spies, kataskopos. And the police officer saying, let's talk to them. So we give our story. "We, your servants, are but humble school teachers in the American Academy." And, of course, everybody in the island knew about the American Academy. So finally, the police officer thought that these guys that arrested us were a couple of bozos, but it took a while. By which time, the whole village had heard American CIA spies had been caught, and they had all gathered in a big crowd right outside the police station. And they were making an increasing amount of noise. At which point, the officer, at what I later realized was some risk to himself, very quickly and suddenly, in his uniform, got up, said to the others, "They're not spies," and then let us out the door, led us right through the crowd to our car, said to us, "Get in and drive as fast as possible," which was a challenge because my car was a 2-cylinder, 6/10 liter engine, but we did our best. You wind that out in first gear, and you, anyway. But we got away, and God was merciful. But I remember the growing awareness that not only did we have to deal with the guys in the office, we had to deal with the whole village outside there who were all quite angry, and they looked for some reason to somebody to blame. Aaron, remember when he made the golden calf? By the way, it's probably a bull, and the calf is simply the Hebrew making fun of it. When he made the golden calf and Moses came down, Moses afterwards says, "Aaron, what were you thinking?" And Aaron says, "The people made me do it," i.e., a mob. Now, whether that's true or not, who knows, but that was Aaron's excuse. When Jesus was on trial before Pilate and a huge crowd gathered out there in front of the governor's residence, even though the governor had a significant number of Roman troops, when the crowd started chanting, "Crucify him, crucify him," Pilate thought it was wise to give way, and he sent Jesus off to be crucified. Paul was attacked by a mob in the temple, and they were intent upon killing him until he was finally rescued by Roman soldiers who were dealing with the mob so furious that they had to put him up above their heads to carry him out back up under arrest, but their arrest. There are mobs today. I have been really distressed at the number of, not the number of Twitter mobs, but the number of prominent and presumably competent people who give in and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I take it back." And the number of people who have lost their jobs because a mob has gone after them, tweeting out this, that, or the other. Now, I've never been on that platform, but it seems to be quite powerful to gather together a mob that has power and influence in this country right now. And what bothers me more than the mobs is the cowardice of the people that they go after, who just back down and back down and quit and back down and get fired. Because mobs are like bullies. The way to deal with a bully is to stand up to him. And the way to deal with a mob is not to back down. Caleb and Joshua did not back down. They were men of courage. And Israel began to pick up stones to throw at them. They could easily have lost their lives. And then God suddenly appeared at the tent. And all Israel suddenly remembered that there's a God. And they were afraid. That was wise. And God spoke to Moses and said, they all deserve to die. And Moses said, yes, but if you do that, everybody will say you brought them out of Egypt, but you weren't strong enough to take them into Canaan. And God says, all right, and listen carefully, I forgive them. But all the men 20 and older who saw my works, they will not enter the land of Canaan. Instead, you're going to wander 40 years in the wilderness, 1 year for each day that the spies were in Canaan. And the only men over 20 who are going to enter Canaan are Joshua and Caleb, who were faithful. And so Israel went off to wander, forgiven in a sense. And God says, in the end, your children will enter. The children that you said will become prey to the Canaanites, and they'll be sold into slavery, and they'll be slaughtered. They're the ones who are going to enter. And 40 years later, when Moses is talking to them and reminding them of all these events, he says, now don't be like your fathers. So Israel, 40 years later, invaded Canaan from the east, while, interestingly enough, the Philistines were invading from the west, from the seashore. You can go to one of the minor prophets for that. And the Canaanites were defeated. It took some years, but they were defeated. And then Joshua divided up the land among the tribes. Judah got this great big chunk of land in the south. And in Israel, in the north, there's lots of rain. And in the middle, there's some rain. And in the south, there is less rain. So Judah did not get the best land. But they got the biggest piece of land. And after the fighting was over, and all the major battles were over, there were still some places that the Canaanites were holding out. And we go now to the book of Joshua and read about Caleb one more time. We have Caleb speaking now to Joshua, his old comrade as a spy who was full of faith and hope. And here is what Caleb says to Joshua. Then the children of Judah came to Joshua in Gilgal. That would be a city right down close to the Jordan River. And Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, said to him, you know the word which the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought back word to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. So Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land where your foot has trodden shall be your inheritance and your children's forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God. And now, behold, the Lord has kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years. Ever since the Lord spoke this word to Moses, while Israel wandered in the wilderness, and now here I am this day, 85 years old. As yet I am as strong this day as on the day that Moses sent me. Just as my strength was then, so now is my strength for war, both for going out and for coming in. Now therefore, give me this mountain of which the Lord spoke in that day. For you heard in that day how the Anakim were there, and that the cities were great and fortified. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said." Now, this is something. He's 85. He's fully aware of what it means to be 85. When you're 85, you just don't know when you're going to be 86. And then you turn into 87. So he's 85. Time is passing. And he asks for the hills where the giants lived. And they hadn't conquered them yet. These were hills south-southwest of Jerusalem, the hills of Hebron, about 3,000 feet above sea level. Hebron was later the capital city of King David for 7.5 years. And he says, "Let me have Adam there in Hebron." So Joshua says, "All right, the Hebron hills are yours." And Caleb went down, presumably with his retainers and his extended family. And we read in chapter 15 of Joshua that he drove out the giants. This is Joshua 15, beginning in verse 13. "Now to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, he gave a share among the children of Israel. And Caleb drove out the three sons of Anak from there, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak. And then he headed further south to another city, still up in the mountains, that they took the name later Debir. And Caleb still had an unmarried daughter. In those days, if you had an unmarried daughter, you were responsible for that daughter and responsible to find her a husband. So Caleb said to everybody with him, "Whoever conquers the next city," Debir was the name it came to be, "he gets to marry my daughter Aksha." We know nothing more about Aksha except she's Caleb's daughter and apparently worth fighting for. So they went and attacked Debir, and Caleb's nephew, Othniel, led in the conquering, so Othniel gets to marry Aksha. And they get the land they just conquered. Now remember what I said about rainfall? Lots in the north, where Mount Hermon is, less in the Galilee area and in Samaria, and then it really tapers off as you get towards Beersheba all the way in the south. So Debir is close to the south. So they've got this land, Othniel and Aksha, but it's dry. Unreliable rainfall. So Aksha proposes to Othniel, or Othniel proposes to Aksha. We don't know whose idea it was. The Greek Septuagint names one of them as the originator of the idea, and the Hebrew names the other. And if you are reading closely and get a bunch of English translations, they go 50-50. So half of them basically credit Othniel with the idea, "Hey, ask your father." And Aksha, so, "Hey, Othniel, what do you think about this?" But in any case, Aksha goes to her father and says, "Okay, Dad, you gave us this land, that's great, but it's really dry. Can we have a field with a spring? How do you get water?" "You turn on a faucet and the water comes out." "How do you get water before you have water coming through the pipes?" "Well, ideally, the best way to get water, better than a well, is to have a spring. A spring is where water just comes right out of the ground for you, usually at the bottom of a hill, and the water comes out, and it's usually pretty cold, about 40 degrees on the average. So in old American farmhouses, before you had refrigerators, before you had ice boxes, you would build a spring house, heavily insulated right over top of the spring, and that was your refrigerator. It's where you put your butter and other things. So she says, "Give us a field with a spring." And Caleb says, "Done, and I'll give you a field with two springs." So they get a field with the upper spring And the lower spring, you have to picture probably a sloping field with an upper spring and a lower spring. And there, Othniel and Aksha made their life with the giants chased away and Judah increasingly strengthening its hold on the land. And that's what we have about Caleb. Caleb is the son of a foreigner whom Judah took in and allowed to become their spokesman, age 40. Caleb was a man full of faith and hope. The hope was based on his faith in God's goodness, his promises, his strength, and that he would be with them. And therefore, hope that he would be successful. And if Caleb grows up to be like Caleb, he will read in the Bible someday, if God be for us, who can be against us? And he will believe it, no matter what sort of trouble he faces. And he will be ready to act with courage, which is how Caleb acted. I certainly hope he never faces a mob. But there will be times when he will need to speak for the Lord. Maybe sometimes when he will be given no option but to speak for the Lord. And then it is best that he learn young how to stand his ground and to say, yes, this is what I believe. It can sometimes be awkward. One of my favorite moments is not in high school, which happened often enough, but in graduate school. I was in a seminar with about six others, and something came up, and I said, oh, that reminds me of what Jesus said once. And then I quoted Jesus with full knowledge that I would simply shock everybody there. And everybody was duly shocked into absolute silence. How in the world could I mean, it's such a breach of decorum to quote Jesus. Finally, after about 30 seconds of awkward silence, which I happily just let go on, the professor, later one of the leaders of ACT UP in Philadelphia, the professor rescued the situation and said, it's been a long time since I've heard him quoted. He couldn't bring himself to say the name Jesus. He's just saying, a long time till I've heard him quoted. And so it will be for our children in school sooner or later on one subject or another. And it is best to learn when young how to speak and act with courage. And then to serve the Lord all his life, even into old age, in this case, old age and still ready to go after the enemy, and an old age still interested and eager to take care of his family, because God's people look to the future with hope. That's why we have babies. That's why we get married. That's why we love grandchildren. That's why we pray for them. That's why when in captivity in Babylon, we have children. That's why when kicked out of paradise with no hope of getting back and childbirth going to be painful and hard to get food from the ground, Adam and Eve have children. No baby, no future. No baby, no serpent of the head, serpent's head crushed. That's why during a pandemic, I love it that this congregation is going to have some children during the pandemic. It's a great time to have a child. It says to the whole world, we have hope in God. We have hope in the future. We look forward. We plan. We care about the future. It's not just, let's eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. That's the word of no hope, no faith, and no future. Adam and Lisa, you have given your son a mouthful of a name. Caleb, Alexander, Rennick, Edgar, and my prayer is that Caleb will be Caleb.